Hi, I'm Casey Lyons.
I'm Dan Gorman.
And I'm Greg LeGros, and we're all from See You Next Wednesday and Time Bandits.
And you're listening to The Faculty of Horror.
Where's it at, Monistat?
What's up, Vagisil?
Hi, everyone. This is Alex West with Andrea Subisati. And we're back with our third episode of The Faculty of Horror. We hope you all enjoyed our Valentine's Day episode. I know Andrea and I had a long chat after it, and she made it clear that we would be better just as friends. And, you know, I'm okay now with that. So we decided for this third episode, with our new friendship intact, that we were going to talk about one singular movie, because we've done two compare contrasts, and both of them were from older movies, so we thought we'd pick one from the last 5 years, and we came to a final decision of Jennifer's Body, written by Diablo Cody, directed by Karen Kasuma, starring Megan Fox as the titular Jennifer, and Amanda Seyfried as her BFF Needy.
So Jennifer's Body came out in 2009, and I didn't see it right away. I have to admit, once again, same as with Fatal Attraction, I've only seen it really recently, mostly for the sake of the podcast. And there was a lot of discourse and argumentation about this movie when it came out. And a lot of it had to do with whether or not this film was a feminist film, or rather, whether or not it was an anti-feminist film. And it's a question that's come up before. When Alex and I first met, it was doing the Fright Bites Women in Horror episode hosted by Leanne Spiderbaby around this time last year. And we talked about our favorite feminist characters in film. And what I said then, and I still believe to be true now, is that an unfeminist film is one that features female characters that are just kind of slotted into the virgin horror binary or are otherwise stereotyped as just helpless and stupid. So I guess, in my opinion, then, a feminist film, therefore, would be one that depicts women as competent, with an appropriate level of complexity, one that has women doing women things and not being shamed or punished for them. Now, in a recent interview I did with Tal Zimmerman, he's working on a documentary, I said this to Tal, and he asked me what that would look like to give him an example of what these girls would be doing in my fantasy feminist movie. And I was actually completely at a loss. I can chalk that up to my lack of imagination, my inability to write fiction to save my life. But I can say that the movies that I mentioned in that Fright Bites episode, such as Martyrs and The Descent, were really good examples of it.
Yeah, similar to Andrea, I thought the movie sounded like a really cool idea. I grew up loving Hole, and Jennifer's Body was probably one of my favorite songs when I was about 11. But something kind of kept me from seeing it. I thought it looked really ambitious, but I didn't think they could pull it off. And I think that was the year I was doing my master's, so I was probably stuck at a library chained to a bookshelf somewhere and didn't get out to see it. And then it kind of came and went with very little fanfare. All the hype died down pretty quickly afterwards. And then it popped up on Netflix last year, and I think one night I was just kind of bored and gave it a shot. Wound up being a lot more into it than I ever expected, and it's always kind of stayed in the back of my mind, and one of the purposes of this podcast is to get Andrea to watch movies I like so we can talk about them. So I think that's one of the reasons why I suggest it, and also because while I like the movie, I think there are a lot of problems inherent within it. So I thought it'd be a great way to talk about some of the bigger themes and then how some of them don't quite work as well as they could.
Right. I had also completely prejudged the movie as a really sexist hot girl slasher, one that would completely subscribe to the stock female horror character. It's just a movie about a female slasher using her sexuality. So I think that was what the critics were saying. That's what I expected. And I couldn't have believed that such a premise could be done well. So before we get into the main themes, Alex is going to give us a synopsis of the film.
And how? So Jennifer's Body starts in the small town of Devil's Kettle. And we meet Jennifer and her best friend, Needy. Jennifer is the hot babe of the town. Needy is her kind of homely, but pretty in that she's all that kind of way. Like, you take off her glasses, flat iron her hair, she'd probably be really hot. And looking at Amanda Seyfried, she is. And Needy has a loving boyfriend named Chip, and Jennifer is just kind of out and about with all the men of the town. Jennifer, we learn this pretty quickly, Jennifer bullies Needy a lot to get her to do things with her. So while Needy may have the interesting name, it's actually Jennifer that's quite dependent on her. Jennifer gets Needy to join her at a small bar just on the outskirts of their town to see this really cool, sexy band from the city. So they go to the club. They meet the band Low Shoulder, who just seem like scummy sketch bags, and they proceed to stay and watch the show. Jennifer seems entranced by it. Needy thinks these guys are kind of creepy and just wants to go. Midway through their first song, a fire starts. It's kind of implied that there's some kind of supernatural element to the fire, but very quickly the bar burns down. Needy and Jennifer escape, only to be confronted by Nikolai, the lead singer of Low Shoulder, who gets Jennifer to come in his van with them. Now, through this, there has been some talk among the band as to whether Jennifer is a virgin or not. Jennifer kind of privately says to Needy, "I'm not even a backdoor virgin."
"Those guys are rank, Jen. Just forget about it.
You know what? I think the lead singer wants me.
Only because he thinks that you're a virgin. I heard them talking."
"What? I'm not even a backdoor virgin anymore, thanks to Roman. And by the way, that hurts. I couldn't even go to Flags the next day. I had to stay home and sit on a bag of frozen peas."
But lo and behold, Jennifer gets into the van. There's an incredibly sad moment where Needy, who's trying to stop her, actually just catches her glance for about a second while the van door closes. Needy then drives home, calling her boyfriend. She's freaked out. She's scared. So many people have died. She doesn't know what happened to Jennifer. She just wants to go and get Jennifer and make sure she's safe. Jennifer then appears at her house, covered in blood and grime and God knows what else, proceeds to try to eat some food out of her fridge and then vomits some kind of black CGI liquid all over her kitchen floor. And from there, the rest of the story kind of takes care of itself. Jennifer is a succubus demon entity, still her lovely bitchy self, and she's eating boys to stay beautiful and hot and in a really great mood. Needy catches on to this pretty quickly and is trying to figure out how to stop her. Now, this all climaxes at the prom/spring formal, where Jennifer goes after Needy's boyfriend, Chip. Needy then rushes to the scene, determined to stop Jennifer, only to be too late. While she manages to tell Jennifer off, Chip dies in her arms, and it's actually pretty heartbreaking. Needy then confronts Jennifer in her room, stabs her in her heart, or her tit, as Jennifer might say, and kills the demon. But during the struggle, Jennifer manages to bite Needy, transferring the demon power to her. So while Needy is locked in an insane asylum, she still has the powers of a demon and manages to escape, hitches a ride with Lance Henriksen, goes to the city, and takes out her vengeance on Low Shoulder, which is what we'd all like to do to a bunch of emo bands.
So was Needy being blamed in the end for all the murders? Like, did she get pinned for all of them, or just the Jennifer murder that she was caught in cold blood?
I'm not sure. It's not explained at all. I think it would make sense that she was blamed for all of them because they don't really have any other explanation now that Jennifer's dead. But who knows? Definitely Jennifer. That's enough to send you to a mental asylum murdering someone that beautiful and sexy. So going back to our kind of initial thesis question of, is this a feminist movie or not? And, you know, I should also say at this point, both Diablo Cody and Karen Kasuma, the director, were very vocal in saying that this is a feminist film. So I think it's hard to go in there and not wonder and really dissect whether it is or not. Now, it took me a couple of viewings to really think that it is a feminist film, but I truly believe this is. I know there are a lot of problems with Jennifer using her sexuality, and that's why a lot of people say this isn't a feminist film. But you also have to take into consideration that Jennifer is not the protagonist in this film. It is Needy. Needy is the one who eventually gains the power from the bite from Jennifer, goes to the city and murders Low's shoulder without using her sexuality. I mean, you don't quite see it in the end, but it's pretty much assumed she just walked in there and started stabbing them, which is, you know, and if feminism is all about equality, then I don't think you can get much more equal than a woman walking in with a knife and just murdering a bunch of idiot men. I mean, that's, you know, gender's reverse. That's what happens in, you know, 90% of the slasher films. And the way I've really come to look at Jennifer's body through all my recent viewings of it is that Jennifer represents the male-constructed version of a female. She's sexy, she's flirty, she's a little dumb, and she's kind of bitchy. While Needy represents the kind of societal construct of a woman. She's kind, she's empathetic, she's loving, she cares about people more than herself, probably. And it is only when you kind of have the two clash, some of the power taken from one of them and pushed into a new one, that you have a totally new version of a woman emerge. And that's what the film walks away with. So I totally believe that Jennifer's Body is a complete feminist film.
I think a lot of the feminist and progressive themes in Jennifer's Body is in satire. And I think that's why a lot of people kind of missed it. I loved it. I believed the characters. I laughed my ass off, which, if you know me, I don't even see comedy movies ever because I'm always just rolling my eyes and miserable. And yeah, I'm just a miserable person and I don't like to laugh, I guess. But Jennifer's Body cracked me up. I thought the dialogue was unexpectedly crass and crude, and it reminds me of how I talk to my girls, which I love to see that in a film. It feels really honest, especially with regard to Jennifer and Needy's friendship. And I loved that they were kind of raunchy without being total morons. But all that said, I did think that the movie slipped up a couple of times. There were a couple of scenes where the satire missed the mark. And I think this is where the critics really had their heyday. You know, there's that one scene where Jennifer is swimming nude across the lake. There's a huge bird's eye view. And I really loved that shot at first because I was like, oh, she's a predator now. She's one with nature. She's like an animal. She looks like a crocodile going through the water. And then there's this Fast Times at Ridgemont High ripoff sequence where she gets up, pulls herself up the ladder all dripping and wringing out her hair. And I just rolled my eyes. I was like, are you serious? You just ruined that. What the hell? And the other scene I didn't really get was the Needy makeout. I mean, we're going to talk at length about Needy and Jennifer's friendship and the power dynamics between them and stuff. But I remember when Cruel Intentions came out. Mm-hmm. And I was in high school, and all anyone was talking about with that movie was the French kiss between Sarah Michelle Gellar and Selma Blair, which was kind of, I really like that movie. It's a great classic story. It was kind of a modernization of Dangerous Liaisons. I thought it was really smart and stylish with really good performances, great sets, great costumes, banging soundtrack. So here's Jennifer's Body, and they pretty much replicate that extreme close-up with their tongues and every drop of spit that passes between them. And like, I resented it in Cruel Intentions because I thought it was a cheap gimmick that was beneath the movie, and I feel even more so about it in Jennifer's Body. I don't know why they did that. I don't know if that was just supposed to be just kind of a nod to the genre, saying, well, here's a bit of this now because this is what you've come to expect, but it's a crying shame.
Yeah, I've heard some mention of that kiss being about the intensity of a female relationship and that attraction you have to a female friend. But as a woman myself, at least, I'm a woman, with a lot of very attractive, beautiful female friends, I've never really wanted to make out with them. Sorry, Andrea.
You liar.
Well, I mean, you know, you said no and then I felt bad.
Her hand is on my leg. And I also thought it was interesting that that makeout scene kind of came in the midst of them fighting. So I don't know if that was kind of a satirical jab at Jennifer kind of deflecting from the real issue, which was their argument, by using her sexuality. And I'll just distract Needy with my tongue in her mouth. Maybe that was it, but I don't like it.
I actually thought that too, because there is that sense of Needy kind of pulling away, and then she just becomes engrossed in the kiss. And if that is what it was, it just needed to be clearer. And I think a lot of the times where this movie misses the mark, it just needed to be clearer. For instance, another big thing I had a problem with, and it's mentioned very subtly, I believe, twice in the film, But it's never explained, and it matters a lot to the ending of the film. And that's the seemingly psychic connection between Needy and Jennifer. So when Needy's having sex with her boyfriend, Chip, she starts seeing blood pour through the ceiling, and then she looks to the side while her boyfriend's on top of her and sees, you know, the dead jock and a demonic Jennifer sitting next to him. That's never quite explained, except Needy runs out of the house and then encounters Jennifer, and they have that big talk about what happened to her. And then it happens again at the spring formal, where it's kind of, you know, cutting between Needy at the dance by herself, I assume waiting for her boyfriend to see what's going to happen, and Jennifer, you know, seducing Chip and getting him to kiss her. And you see a moment where Jennifer and Chip are kissing, and then it cuts back to Needy, and you see her touch her lips as though she's feeling some kind of pressure, like a kiss on them. And that's when she realizes, oh no, Chip's in danger, and she runs out of the dance and goes to find them. That's a really cool, interesting element to the movie, but they needed to, I don't know, throw some ADR in there and explain it, because I don't know what that is. I don't know how the connection started, if it's real, if it's imagined. Again, very cool, but you need to explain that kind of stuff if you're going to introduce it as a major plot point.
Jennifer's here.
How do you know?
Quit shampooing yourself and get down here.
That's fucking weird.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about this essay written by Laura Mulvey in 1975 called Visual Pleasures in Narrative Cinema. And yeah, it's a sexy fucking essay. It's also an essay if you've ever even taken like a film 101 class or wandered past one at some point in your university career. You probably will have heard about this because it is a feminist theory, but it's one of the most commonly taught things in a film class because it's deeply interesting and it's a great way to just kind of frame any argument. So the gist of this essay is that the gaze or the use of a shot in almost any film is inherently a male gaze, that it's, you know, a male protagonist looking upon something, and that other thing is usually a woman. So it's the active versus passive division of labor. Now, most films have a male protagonist who's identifiable for the white male viewer, albeit this protagonist usually is better looking and is a more extroverted version of themselves. Female characters become objects as the camera fetishizes their body. And again, this really enforces gender stereotypes, making women possessions and passive. So men dictate and move action forward, whereas female characters tend to react. Now, Mulvey really posits this in film noir, and that's a great example of it. And it's also, a lot of those films are told through flashbacks and a narration. So you get to see this kind of, I remember when that dame walked into that bar and she was sexy. That's a direct quote from the Maltese Falcon. Just even to start at looking at Jennifer's body, it's very interesting because the film begins with Needy in the mental institution narrating, you know, we weren't always like this, and I'm a kicker, and I'm this, and I'm that. And now I'm going to tell you the story of how this really sweet, nice girl got into this place.
I wasn't always this cracked. I used to be normal. Well, as normal as any girl under the influence of teenage hormones. But after the killings began, I started to feel, I don't know, loose around the edges or something.
So already we have inversion of, you know, the male gaze. We are about to see a film through female eyes, which is unfortunately very, very rare. And like any film dealing with narration, you always have to kind of posit that idea that it's an unreliable narrator. Another film similar is that uses this technique is something like Rosemary's Baby. Even though she's not narrating it, we follow Rosemary through this journey of figuring out that she's born the devil's child. And so we understand that, but there is a very real possibility that she just has mental issues.
You could hear them singing through the wall. Guy, my husband, Guy, said it was Dr. Shand, one of these people, playing a recorder. Now, how did he know it was Dr. Shand unless he was there with them?
And because of our privileged viewpoint of being able to see the events through Needy, we understand that there is a demon inside of Jennifer. It's not as though we're seeing the film events through Chip's eyes, where he just believes, you know, Needy just might need some psychological help.
It's definitely a very feminine gaze, and I saw myself a lot in it, which I really can't say about a lot of movies, even ones featuring groups of women and a female perspective. I mean, The Craft I related to on a certain level. My friends in high school were real bitches. But in this one, I saw myself a lot in it, and I remember being in high school, and I remember finally developing the breasts I was scared I would never get. And getting all this attention from boys and feeling a real sense of power in being able to get that attention. You know, it's a fleeting, superficial power, but I remember what it feels like. I mean, the power is still there. I still have the breasts, but I...
You still have the power, trust me.
But I do remember what it feels like to be empowered by that kind of power, whereas now I feel like more and more I'm kind of resisting it or having to temper it, having to filter it with appropriateness and downplay it a little bit for the sake of my brain, which is too bad. But when they're in the bar and Jennifer talks about how her boobs give them the power to do whatever they want, I thought that was really powerful thing to say. I'd say it was an accurate interpretation of the world through a teenage girl's eyes in our culture, not because she's stupid or a skank, but because these are the lessons our society has taught them. Now, I remember thinking that way and acting that way and watching losers in bands with adoring puppy dog eyes, and I did all of that, and I found such an honest portrayal of that perspective to be really, really refreshing.
I think they need 2 groupies.
No, come on.
Don't be so JV, Needy. They're just boys. Morsels, we have all the power. Don't you know that these things? These are like smart bombs, okay? You point them in the right direction and shit gets real.
And nowhere in the movie does Jennifer seem to think that she's above so much else or this is the only right way to do something. This is the easiest way she's found to get power. And, you know, she's not as smart as Needy. She doesn't have all the things that Needy has, like a caring boyfriend, and she's probably not as smart as Needy, and she probably knows that. So there is a sense that she's just kind of playing on her sexuality because that's what she's figured out will get her where she wants to be, even if that's just power over men for the time being. Now, another thing I noticed in my rewatches of this movie was, so the male gaze is obviously used a lot in slasher films. We see that, you know, time and again. You know, you get it in Peeping Tom and Psycho and Black Christmas and Halloween. They all have some kind of point of view shot. So if we take Jennifer's body as one big point of view shot from Needy, there's a lot more empathy and humanity in this slasher film than anyone else. You know, I love that the male victims are portrayed as full and complete people with different sides to their personality. And even, you know, when the jock dies at the hands of Jennifer, you see his parents wailing at his body coming out, and that's heartbreaking. And then when she kills Colin, the kind of emo goth kid, you know, you see the funeral, and you see the mom being unable to walk away from the coffin. So there is a sense of women understanding something much deeper and in a much deeper way. So it's a pretty emotional film, and it's absolutely just as funny as Andrea says. But there are moments of profound humanity, which is a pretty interesting dichotomy for this movie.
And I found the relationship between Needy and Jennifer really interesting. And Alex already mentioned that, you know, Jennifer has a latent jealousy of Needy, you know. And I think Needy does, in a certain extent, kind of live vicariously through Jennifer's beauty and her attention and kind of just rolling her eyes and stuff. But I found it really interesting that Needy's character is not actually a needy human being at all. She's very independent. Her mom is largely absent in the brain. She made the decision to have sex with her boyfriend without any coercion from him or even peer pressure from Jennifer, really. But I found especially powerful moment when Jennifer's starting to look like shit because she needs to eat somebody fast And they're kind of talking about that as they walk through the hall. Like, God, you look really tired. Yeah, I kind of feel like shit. Oh, here's this Colin guy. And Jennifer is not at all interested in Colin, not even to eat him and make herself feel better, until Needy says, well, I think he's pretty cute, you know, and if I didn't have a boyfriend, who knows? And that's when Jennifer turns around and he becomes a conquest and he becomes, you know, just kind of a jab at Needy from Jennifer. And I thought that was a really realistic thing that girls do to show power over each other, a little shitty alpha female thing. But I have never seen that in movies and I loved it.
Colin's really nice. He's into maggot rock. He wears nail polish.
My dick is bigger than his.
Well, I think he's really cool.
You do?
Yeah. Wait, Colin.
So I think a lot of people's problems with this movie happen to stem from one of its leading ladies, and that would be Megan Fox. Now, when this film came out in 2009, she had just come off of the second Transformers film, I believe, which I did actually happen to see. And I wanted to stab my eyes. It was so bad. I took my nephew to see it. So, you know, the things we do. Now, there was a lot of hatred around Megan Fox at this point, and she just kind of come out and she was, you know, being very outspoken, which, oh no, women speaking their minds. That's terrifying, right? You know, she was calling out Michael Bay that he was Hitler on set. She was saying all this stuff and it kind of came off as a bit presumptuous and, you know, biting the hand that feeds you. So she was doing all this promotional work for Jennifer's Body and people just came down on her. And I didn't quite get it at the time because she just seemed like a girl who was kind of fed up and, you know, she's a sex symbol, but yeah, I'm a sex symbol who has a mouth, so I'm going to use it and you can all deal with it. And the thing is, because she has that great dichotomy in her, she makes for a great interview. So she was on the cover of lots of magazines and she was posited as the, you know, perfect woman of the year. And a lot of us don't look like her. I mean, I do. I you know, constantly, all the time, Esquire, stop calling me. You know, so there is that kind of thing where you feel this resistance to her, because if you're told that all the men like her, then you could just kind of feel like, just like we were talking about in the movie, it's like you want to give her a big fuck you.
I liked how she had a bad girl in Hollywood thing going on through being outspoken and not through, you know, banging her co-stars, banging her employers, or shitty publicity stunts that didn't make any sense. I thought she had great style. I liked her tattoos. I always liked her. I mean, a bad actress is a bad actress, and an actress who takes bad roles that you resent is really annoying. But I thought Megan Fox did a fantastic job in Jennifer's Body. I thought when she was being tongue-in-cheek, it really came off tongue-in-cheek. I appreciated that she was able to be absolutely disgusting. Like in that scene where she's barfing the CGI crap, like Alex mentioned, it's, you know, she's not afraid to look bad for the sake of the character. And I respect that in an actress, especially one who's so celebrated for being a sex symbol.
Yeah, I think it's actually a very intelligent performance. I think it's a very thoughtful performance. It's definitely worth watching because, you know, she has some great comic timing, as Andrea was saying. She doesn't mind looking ugly and freaky. She gets it. She understands what she's doing. And I don't know how many of you out there know actors, but a lot of actors don't even know that much. So among all the many wonderful and splendid things that Jennifer's Body is, it also manages to use several different horror tropes and genres, or rather subgenres, to examine a female friendship. Now, Diablo Cody is quite vocal in her love of horror films. In fact, kind of just mirroring what we were talking about with Megan Fox, as soon as it was announced she was going to do polishes on the upcoming Evil Dead remake script, there was a lot of anger on ye old interwebs just about her and what kind of writer she is. But, you know, that's another podcast for another time. But anyway, she loves movies and she loves horror movies. So why not write about them and why not use a couple different styles in one movie? So the first off, and probably the most obvious, which we have already dropped in a couple times, is a slasher film. And that's pretty, you know, that's a pretty common genre. So Needy, who is our final girl in this case, rather than face a male monster, actually faces the female monster, which is Jennifer. And this monster plays into the fantasy of men to get them to submit to her. Now, one of the things that happens in a slasher film, and what's often talked about in academia, what we have talked about actually back in our first podcast, is the transference of female to male back to female genders of the final girl. So final girls start off, and while they're kind of more butch than their friends, they're generally female for the most part. And then when they have to fight back and attack, they take on male traits. They usually grab the knife, which becomes their phallic symbol. They become stronger and more attuned with what's going on. So those are all things that are, you know, unfortunately just associated with men in some cases. And then once they have defended themselves and beat off the monster, at least for the time being, they drop the knife and revert back to a female role where they're either being taken away in an ambulance or a man is helping them, so they become female again. In Jennifer's Body, that doesn't happen. Needy takes the knife and doesn't let go. She actually just breaks out of a mental institution, finds the knife used on Jennifer, and takes it and just kills the shit out of Lo's shoulder, which is awesome.
Can I just point out that you said that the final girl beats off the monster? I mean, you said a lot of really smart stuff, but that was funny.
God, I totally did.
I also thought Needy as a final girl was interesting in that she has to save Chip and she fails. I thought that was a really interesting subversion of most slasher films where, you know, there's kind of a knight in shining armor who comes to save the girl. And in Needy's case, especially when shit was starting to really hit the fan and she was genuinely scared for everyone and wanted to focus all her energies on keeping an eye on Jennifer and trying to stop Jennifer, she actually breaks up with Chip in the hopes of keeping him safe and keeping him at a distance. And I thought that was really interesting that, again, Needy isn't all that needy. You know, she doesn't need him to believe her. She doesn't need him to help her. She needs him to duck and cover, which he fails at.
Oh, man, does he ever.
Well, what about the dance?
Who cares about the goddamn dance, Chip?
I do. I ordered your corsage. It's an orchid. It was like $12.
I'll be at the dance. I just need to keep an eye on Jennifer.
Promise me you're not going to go.
Needy, I'm not your guy anymore.
Chip, it's not safe for us to be together right now.
The next subgenre that they tackle in the film is the possession movie. Now, in a lot of possession movies, it's usually a woman that is either possessed or attacked. So you see this most obviously in The Exorcist or even something like The Entity, which are both really great and interesting films in their own right. And who knows, maybe one day we'll get to talking about those. But in possession movies, generally it is a woman in danger because women are seen as more open and empathetic. So they are a better vessel for a demon to possess. You know, we see that again also in something like Paranormal Activity. Now, in these possession films, it is a male protagonist, such as, you know, Father Karras in The Exorcist, who is able to recognize the possession and put a stop to it, sometimes through other help and through other general male characters. But it is them that puts a stop to the madness. They are able to keep their head above water and make a smart decision. Now, in Jennifer's Body, the men are unable or unwilling to stop the possession from happening or even to save themselves, because the more Jennifer feeds and the more she takes care of this demon inside of her, the more beautiful and alluring she becomes. So even when these men are almost in mortal danger, it's far too late for them to save themselves. Now, the other, and for me, this was the final one I took away from. And again, if you see any other kind of subgenres in this movie, please let us know, because we'd love to hear it. So the other subgenre I recognized was the rape revenge. So you see this in things like The Last House on the Left or I Spit on Your Grave. So instead of a rape, it is Jennifer who is tied down and taunted by these men, these shitty emo musicians taunting her and singing at her and making fun of her. And they don't even remember her name. And they mock her while stabbing her. And it is so painful and brutal. It was a really hard scene for me to watch, because it was all the guys are giving fun performances. And the look in Jennifer's eyes is one of blind fear. And I can't even imagine what that must be like.
With the deepest malice, we deliver this virgin unto thee.
Dude, that is a hot murder weapon.
It's a Bowie knife.
Bowie? Nice.
All right, here we go. It's going to be gnarly.
No, please, please. No, please,
wait a
God.
Second. I just thought of something.
Jenny. Jenny, you're the girl for me. You know, you don't know me, but you make me so happy. I tried to call you before, but I lost my nerve. I used my imagination, but I was disturbed.
Jenny, I've got your number. I need to make you mine. Jenny, don't change your number.
In these rape revenge movies, generally speaking, it is the rural versus the city kind of life. So it is a more educated woman, generally speaking, who it goes to the country to get away from some aspect of the city life, and she is attacked and punished and, you know, raped often repeatedly, you know, and then it becomes a warning sign of this America that we don't fully know because these are towns we have forgotten about. Now, in Jennifer's Body, they again subvert this by having, you know, a city band come into the rural town of Devil's Kettle and Jennifer trying to take on, you know, what she thinks a city girl would do. And that's what ultimately gets her into trouble.
Talking a little bit about I Spit on Your Grave, I did an episode of the Rue Morgue podcast. I actually did two episodes of the Rue Morgue podcast to talk about that film because it was so contentious about a woman using her sexuality to dish out revenge. And also the fact that in I Spit on Your Grave, this is a city woman besieged by hillbillies is, you know, these city women are progressive, right? They're independent. They hold their heads up high. They drive a car and they pump their own gas. And that's really what pisses these hillbillies off. Whereas in the case of Jennifer, his body, I felt like, you know, this band was just hoping to prey on her ignorance and her innocence. And she was innocent to a certain extent because she got in the stupid van, but she wasn't so innocent physically because they were hoping she was a virgin and she was not even close. I think it's important to remember that the film is called Jennifer's Body because it's very much about Jennifer's body. It's about her relationship with her body, how she wields it before she was a demon and after she became a demon. And, you know, her demonhood didn't actually stipulate that any sex had to happen. It's not like she could only absorb the power of these men through some sexual anything. She chose to use her sexuality, and it's because that was what she knew would work. And once again, I feel like that is a lesson taught by society and not her being stupid, but just her making use of the tools that she's been given and taught to use.
Yeah, I do not think Diablo Cody or Karen Kasuma is, or even Megan Fox is saying that, you know, this is a feminist film because she uses sex and isn't that subversive. I think they're trying to show us that this is the only power source that women have that is readily accepted. It's not necessarily our brains or our smarts or, you know, us being physical. It is our sexuality that is most prized and that is most desired. And another interesting facet, even though Needy is our final girl and our protagonist, we spend a lot of time with Jennifer, and that even though she's our monster, she's a complicated monster, almost on par with Frankenstein in terms of a sympathetic monster, I would say. And what I really like what Kasuma did was she gave Jennifer these fleeting moments of real vulnerability that are quite challenging because we have to accept those moments in the rest of what she is. Yes, she's sexual and she's hot and she's so beautiful, but she has moments of pain and longing. And that is often hard to, you know, put those two things next to each other, and especially in a movie that's 90 minutes, and that's not even your real protagonist. Now, those two moments I identify as the moment, which I mentioned earlier, where Jennifer is kind of pushed into this van by the guys in low shoulder, and Needy's trying to get her out, and then Needy kind of gives up because she realizes she's just going to go. And Jennifer catches Needy's glance, and there's this hopeless, wondrous look in her eyes, and it's really quite profound and it's quite moving. And the other is towards the end of the film when Jennifer is getting ready for the dance, And she hasn't fed in a little while, so she's not looking that great for Megan Fox. And she starts smearing, you know, foundation on her face, and then she's just like putting it like all over her lips and her eyes. And it's for any woman that's ever applied makeup in the hopes of trying to make herself feel better, it's a pretty powerful moment. Now, one of the problems I had with Jennifer's body is that in the moment where Needy finally takes the box cutter, which nicely done, to dispense with Jennifer, she stabs Jennifer in the heart after this struggle and after she's ripped off the best friends forever necklace. And she stabs Jennifer in the heart and Jennifer just goes, "My tet," in this really odd Valley Girl voice. And then Needy goes, "No, your heart."
"My tet. No, your heart."
Now, what's interesting is I interpreted that scene so differently. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciated it because I felt like it really illustrated Jennifer's relationship to her own body, like I mentioned, as being a major theme in the movie, that, that you know, you've just hurt one of my weapons. And what she actually did was, you know, she got her in her most vulnerable spot, and that refers to both her heart, you know, as the organ, and her breast as, you know, a weapon of sexuality that she wielded. So I thought that little scene kind of really illustrated that point and brought it home nicely.
And that's why we do this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, because Andrea just blew my mind. No, I actually, looking at that scene with that reading, I actually really subscribe to that, and I think it's a great way to do something like that. And again, it's subversive and it's not, you know, all out on the table, and it takes, you know, different minds getting together and talking about it. And that's why we're relevant.
Andrea 1, Alex 0.
Fuck.
You're a jerk. Wow, nice insult, Hannah Montana. You got any more harsh digs?
So another, again, we keep talking about this movie and all these themes it has, and holy shit poops, Batman. There are so many themes in this movie. Another one we wanted to touch on before we start wrapping up is the tragedy boner aspect. Now, after the bar burns down and Low Shoulder becomes heroes and, you know, this really popular band, the town of Devil's Kettle has to unite somehow, and they have to heal. And there is this really cynical outlook on it where, you know, Needy's voiceover comes in and she talks about how stupid they were, believing that it was all going to get better and that this would be the last death. Now, America, obviously we're podcasting from Canada, so we have a privileged viewpoint, but America has a real thing for tragedy boners. They really like getting them. And I say this, you know, after tragedies like Columbine and 9/11, there is a sense that the media portrays of, you know, giving these people attention as a community and that they're healing themselves and that that is making them better. It's not so much the policies that are in place that cause these tragedies to happen, such as, you know, their issues with gun control and their politics overseas, which are, for me anyway, the seed of the problem. It's, no, this is the community, and this is how we heal, and this is how we come together. And it's often, it goes from dealing with a real issue to just everyone patting themselves on the back about it. Now, again, in yet another way that Jennifer's body is a satire and a subversion of all these things is that the town truly believes that Low Shoulder are heroes. They are American heroes because they tried pulling people out of that bar and they were there and they wanted to save people, which is absolutely not the case.
To the rest of the world, we were famous. We were saints. Our town's only bar had burned to the ground and our star linebacker was someone's snack pack. The whole country got a huge tragedy boner for Devil's Kettle. And the press, God, they couldn't get enough of our little world of shit.
So they have this band that's perpetrating a myth, and they're celebrated for it. But because of our vantage point through Needy, we know what kind of assholes they are.
I think there was a poignant little line between Needy and a classmate when they were arguing about what is true. And, well, it was on the Wikipedia. I thought that was a nice little jab at the reliability of media.
Low Shoulder are American heroes? No, they're not. I was there, Chastity. They didn't help anybody escape the fire. I don't even know how that rumor got started.
Rumor? Rumor?
It's true. It's on their Wikipedia.
And that's actually one of the other things I really loved in this movie was the sheer brazen assholishness that the band has and the lead singer Nikolai is played by Adam Brody. And I never got Adam Brody. I never watched The OC or thought he was cute or anything. But he's awesome in this movie. He plays such a douchebag musician and he plays it so well and with such glee that it's great because it makes those scenes really fun to watch and all that more sick and twisted.
Do you know how hard it is to make it as an indie band these days? There's so many of us. We're all so cute, and it's like if you don't get on Letterman or some retarded soundtrack, you're screwed. Okay? Satan is our only hope. We're in league with the Beast now, and we have to make a really big impression on him. And to do that, we're going to have to butcher you and bleed you. And then Dirk here is going to wear your face. Relax, I'm kidding about the face. The rest is going to happen, though.
And the fact that they were willing to murder someone for commercial success, you know, murder a pretty small town girl like Jennifer was totally expendable to them. And they didn't have they didn't lose too much sleep over it at all.
And obviously it worked because I've had that fucking song stuck in my head for the last week. Holy shit.
So to wrap this up, I think the question that Alex and I wanted to answer in dissecting this movie was, is it a feminist film? And even though I have a hard time defining exactly what entails a feminist film, I'm going to give this the thumbs up seal of approval as a portrayal of women I can get behind, one that's realistic, one that's satirical, and one that is so critical and layered that we were able to talk about it for about an hour. So Hellbat gives it thumbs up.
I also think it's a feminist film. And again, as I was saying earlier, it took me a couple watches to really get to that conclusion. I kind of had problems with it because I was like, oh, thinking Jennifer was the main monster and all those things, that she just used her sexuality. And that's not really equality, which to me is what feminism is. But then watching it and looking at the story arc a couple times over, it really is Needy who, because not only is she our narrator, but she's our final girl, and she evolves so much throughout this movie. And then when she becomes still the hero, but also a killer, she doesn't use her sexuality. She uses it to exact revenge on the people that started the wrong. She doesn't necessarily so much blame Jennifer. She attacks the demon within her, and she doesn't like her much as a friend by the end of it. But she goes after those guys. My ultimate problem with Jennifer's Body is I wish they'd cut some stuff out of the middle and actually let us enjoy watching those asshole emo dickheads getting slaughtered by Amanda Seyfried. But, you know, maybe next time.
So to wrap up, we want to thank you all once again for listening. Every single time we put out an episode, the feedback has been great. So if you're going to listen, we're going to keep making them. And what we've decided to do is send us your feedback, post it on Facebook, email it to us at thefacultyofhorror.gmail.com. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to take an entire episode to address some of the comments, arguments, criticisms, and praises you have of the podcast. So send us in what you think and stay tuned for that episode, which I don't know when we're going to do it, but we are.
Yeah, and we also just really, really wanted to thank very quickly Stuart and Lance over at the Rue Morgue podcast because they talked about us. And anytime a man talks about us, my little blogger heart just beats that much faster. And we also just wanted to give an actual shout out, or a more sincere shout out, to our friends over at Modern Superior Network, and that is Casey, Greg, and Dan. They have two podcasts, which are See You Next Wednesday, which deal with contemporary releases and things that are just coming out. And they also have Time Bandits, which deals with films from about 25 years ago. I was a guest on the last episode, which is episode 3, where we talked about Hellbound, Hellraiser 2. I got to go in a time machine. It was super nifty. And when I woke up, all my clothes were still kind of on. So that was exciting. And yeah, they're going to have Andrea on really soon. So check out the episode, which I believe is episode 3. Check that out. Let us know if you have any comments or feedback from that. And be sure to subscribe to them because Andrea, like I say, will be on soon. And it's just a great podcast. It's really fun.
Also, stay tuned for an interview by Alex and I on the Rumorg blog. We were interviewed by Ron McKenzie to talk a little bit about the Faculty of Horror and Women in Horror Month, which will be just about over by the time the blog post goes up, but we talk about it a little bit, so be sure to check that out at rue-morg.com.
And as always, you can like us on Facebook. You can email us, as Andrea just said, at thefacultyofhorror@gmail.com. Where else can you get us? You can get us either individually on Twitter. I'm at ScareAlex.
And I'm at Necromandria.
Hot. So, yeah, that's it for us. Thank you so much again for listening. Now, Andrea and I have to go practice kissing on each other. So that definitely means office hours are closed. And we will talk to you soon.
By the bay.